One of the questions I received is, was the Apocrypha studied by Jesus and the disciples? Why was it removed from the Bible? When was it removed? What standard was used? And by whom did it remove it? When did they remove it? And is the Apocrypha relevant to Christians today? I remember when Carolyn handed me this question, she said, I'm glad you're getting these questions. I don't even understand the question, much less how to give you the answer. So let's, if we can, explain a little of that. And then we're going to get on to some other of the questions that you have posted, and we'll continue to take those through the summer. And the first thing is to recognize that if you have maybe grown up, maybe you went to a Catholic church or school or something like that, and you might have noticed that the Jerusalem Bible is a little bit larger than our Bible, and that is that it has these books known as the Apocrypha. These were written from about 250 B.C. to the time of Christ, which is oftentimes referred to as the intertestamental period. And it is, for example, 1st and 2nd Maccabees and the Wisdom of Solomon and Esdras and Tobit and Bel and the Dragon, a number of different chapters and books in that section. And these were written during the Maccabean period, and that's a reason why sometimes you hear them said. Now, they were not written in Hebrew, as was the Old Testament. Most of the Old Testament was written in Hebrew, and these were actually written in Greek during what is oftentimes referred to as the period of silence. So you might say, okay, I don't see this in any of our Protestant Bibles. Matter of fact, I don't see it in most Bibles, but if you go to a Catholic church, sometimes you will see them there. And I remember a number of years ago, a friend of mine had been going to a Catholic church, and he was with me at Campus Crusade. He ended up being actually a full-time staff member on Campus Crusade. But, you know, I was saying, well, you know, there are some differences in terms of what the Catholics teach and, you know, what we teach in our Bible churches. And he wasn't all that convinced. So I said, okay, well, I'll come up with a deal here. You come with me to my Conservative Baptist church once, and then I'll come with you to your Catholic Mass. And he said, and I don't think we'll see any difference. So we go to the Catholic Mass. Oh, we sit down. The priest stands forward and says, the message today is from 2nd Maccabees. And I turned to him, and that was sort of the end of that. Okay, so again, you might say, okay, what is it about that? Because the Catholic Church has actually had that, and so the Catholic Church, Roman Catholicism, has recognized these 15 different books as authoritative, and add that to the what we call the normal 66 books of our Old and New Testament. And these were actually added. You know, the question said, when were they taken out? No, they were only added to the Bible in the Council of Trent in 1546 and decreed as the actual tradition. So if we can say maybe, okay, since they were added, how were they perceived at the time that they were written? And so I'm going to take you through a couple of things. First of all, what did the Jews think about the Old Testament canon, a canon meaning those which belong in the Bible, which do not? And interestingly enough, in the Jewish period, they basically put their seal of approval on the 24 Old Testament books. Now, if you've done any counting and you look in your table of contents, you'll notice we have 39. Well, the 24 of theirs are the 39 of ours, because today we split them off. We have 1st and 2nd Kings. They just had the Book of Kings. We have 1st and 2nd Chronicles. We just have Chronicles. And we can also see that the Jewish historian Josephus oftentimes talked about the 22 books in the Old Testament canon, and that's because oftentimes in that day when Josephus lived, which is during the kind of the time of Christ, Ruth was oftentimes appended to Judges, and Lamentations was just continued with Jeremiah, because after all, Jeremiah wrote Lamentations. And so you can see that they were looking at the same 39 books that we talk about, even though sometimes they use the number 24 or 22. Does everybody follow that so far? So at the time in which Jesus lived, or even at the time of the Dead Sea Scrolls, something kind of interesting, these 39 books were accepted as part of the Old Testament, and the so-called Maccabean books, or the Apocrypha, were not. But for us as Christians, a lot of the question is, what did Jesus have to say about it? Well, this is where I think it's very easy, because we see that Jesus never quotes from the Apocrypha. But Jesus quotes from nearly every one of those 24 Old Testament books. Now, I recognize that in some respects you might say, well, that's an argument of silence, but it's a pretty powerful argument. Jesus constantly is quoting from the Old Testament, but he never quotes from the Apocrypha. But then you have something even more interesting. In Matthew 23, Jesus sets forth the time of the inspired history of the Old Testament. And he says it begins with the actual killing of Abel. That's the first murder that you see in the Old Testament. And then the killing of Zechariah on the steps of the temple. And so he says this is the time in which you have God's inspiration. Well, you actually, after that period of time, during the Maccabean period, had other people who were martyred. So it's not only an argument from silence, it's also a delineation of this as well. So if you look at this, if Jesus is our standard, Jesus makes it very clear that the Old Testament, 39 books, or what at that time were the 24 books, are the inspired word. And these other books are interesting, but they are not part of something that would use for doctrine. If that's not enough, let me give you two other, I think, very powerful arguments. One is not only to look at what did Jesus say about the Old Testament, what did the New Testament writers say about the Old Testament and the Apocrypha? And again, you can't find any New Testament author who ever quotes from the Apocrypha. And you might say, well, maybe that's because they wouldn't quote from anything other than the Bible. No, you even have, for example, in the New Testament, you see Paul quoting from these pagan poets, Cleanthes and others during that time, and Mars Hill quoting from that. So again, you see that they quote from the Old Testament quite frequently. Never does anyone quote from the Apocrypha. Then if you look at the history, the early church fathers, even more so. You have Jerome, who is the one that gave us the Latin Vulgate, which is used, interesting enough, by the Catholic Church, and was used for some time, until later they added the Apocrypha, and he rejected the idea of the Apocrypha as well. If you even look at history, there was a real kind of debate for a while among the Jews in what was called the Council of Jamnia, and that was the question of whether or not the book of Esther and the Song of Solomon should be in the Old Testament, which they could, it should, but they never did bring up the issue of what? The Apocrypha. So again, you can see that in many cases, I think you stand in pretty good stead by saying that the Apocrypha may have interesting historical note, but you certainly wouldn't want to build doctrine on it. And so this leads to the last question. I just put this on the same slide. Why is it, do many people think, that the Catholic Church later added the Apocrypha to the Bible? And that has to do with the fact that in 2 Maccabees, I spelled it wrong, but I'll change that later, it talks about prayer for the dead so that they may be loosed from their sins. And in the Catholic Church was at that time a teaching of what? Purgatory. And so in some respects, I think it was accepted in part because it seemed to give some kind of doctrinal support for a belief that had been taught at that time. But again, if you look at our Bible, this is a way to understand the Old and New Testament in terms of the categories, almost like a periodic table. But I thought this was a great little diagram because you can see, you know, you first of all have the Pentateuch up there, and then you have the history, and then you have the Psalms and the Proverbs. Then you have the major prophets, then you have the minor prophets. Over on the right-hand side, you have the four Gospels, you have Acts, then you have all of the epistles of Paul, then you have the epistles of the other apostles, and you have the book of Revelation. 66 books, 39 in the Old Testament, 27 in the New Testament, and that is our Bible. Is that helpful at all? While we're there, I thought I might spend just a minute talking about how even archaeology helps answer some of those questions. And that is, first of all, to recognize that when we look at archaeology has confirmed time and time again the historical accuracy of the Old and New Testament. When we look at the Old Testament, you have Millar Burroughs saying that archaeological work has unquestionably strengthened confidence in the reliability of the scriptural record. More than one archaeologist has found his respect for the Bible increased by the experience of excavation in Palestine. Another one, Dr. Nelson Gluck, said, it may be stated categorically that no archaeological discovery has ever controverted, that is, contradicted, if you will, a biblical reference. Scores of archaeological findings have been made which confirm in clear outline or in exact detail statements in the Bible. And so when we come to even something like the Dead Sea Scrolls, what I think is so intriguing is that these Dead Sea Scrolls, which were found, interesting enough, in 1949, these were actually scrolls that were hidden in these caves. And there's some pictures of some of those caves. You know, a little shepherd boy was just throwing rocks, as sometimes they were tend to do. Some say he was trying to get a goat out of a cave, and he heard a tink. And so he, being curious, climbs up there and finds that the thing he had broken actually had, what, these scrolls. And because it's so dry in this area, they have been preserved. And so this also gives us an idea of those who lived in this Qumran community. Did they take the Apocrypha as authoritative? No, but they certainly did revere the Old Testament, what we call our 39 books, or at that time, which were the 24, 22 books, depending on which group you're looking at. And more importantly, the archaeological discovery has helped us look at the transmission, because up until this, the oldest manuscripts we had of the Old Testament were from some monasteries in about AD 900. Now you could go back another 100 years back in time to almost 100 BC, so 1,000 years earlier, to see how accurate the transmission was. And of course, it was very accurate. This particular quote that comes from one of the scholars said that there can be no reasonable doubt that the Qumran manuscripts came from the century before Christ and the first century AD. Thus, they are 1,000 years older than the Masoretic manuscripts of the 10th century, meaning that now we have an ability to show how accurate the transmission was of those manuscripts as well. If you've ever been over to Israel, oftentimes they'll take you into the Israeli library, and this is the Isaiah scroll, which I don't want to mislead you. The Isaiah scroll is very long, almost 18 feet. Some of the other pieces, like when we went over to Southwestern Baptist Seminary and saw the Dead Sea, a lot of you are seeing little scraps, you know, but nevertheless, they are just, even to this day, people still finding new revelations and new understanding of some of these because of these scrolls. And once again, just as providing some tremendous evidence of our faith in terms of the Old Testament. But what about the New Testament? This is kind of interesting, because one of the things we're starting to see is that there is all sorts of archaeological evidence now confirming the New Testament. And in particular, an individual that has been attacked through the last two centuries is Luke. Why? Well, Luke, first of all, wrote the gospel we just looked at, but he also wrote something else. What? The book of Acts. And now, one of the things we're finding, and this documents some of that, but I'll put it on the screen so you can read a little bit better. A classical scholar by the name of Colin Hemmer has actually now documented how the book of Acts is accurate because of all the new things we've learned in terms of archaeology. And this just takes us through the last 16 chapters, really from Acts 13 to the end. And with painstaking detail, he's identified, and I've got the printout here, 84 different facts that are in the book of Acts that have been confirmed by historical and archaeological research. And as I was going through this, I realized this book's a few years old, and we've learned some things since then. The last time we were over there, I was in Greece, and some of you were with us. And when we were at Greece, the individual that was taking us through this, whose name is James. Now, he's a kind of an interesting contradiction, because he looks like the actor Johnny Depp, but he sounds like the archaeologist William Albright. But anyway, he took us to some places and showed us a few other things that have just been discovered in the last couple of years. So the 84 that we listed up there probably are pretty close to 90 now, just from the things I learned from being over in Greece as James was taking us to some of those places, especially in Corinth. And so it's kind of intriguing to see that time and time again, we have all sorts of evidence that confirms our Christian faith. So if nothing else, I think that should encourage you. If that doesn't light your fire, your wood is wet, because I thought that's pretty fun stuff. But let's get to our next set of questions. These came online. What are the differences between the Sunni and Shiite Muslims, and is it worth killing each other for? So that's the first set of questions we're going to look at in this category, and then we'll get to some more in just a minute. And so, again, let's, if we can, give just a little bit of understanding of what Islam is, and then why is there such a difference between Sunni Muslims and Shiite Muslims, and why are they killing each other? You know, if ISIS comes across anybody that's a Shiite Muslim, they will kill them just like they would kill another pagan. And so where does that start, and what kind of historical background is there? Well, the first is when we talk about Muslims, which recognize that certainly a large percentage of those who are Muslims live in the Middle East, about 380 million. But you also have quite a number in Northern Africa, 115 million. But actually, the country that has more Muslims than any other country is Indonesia. And you have 550 Muslims that live in places like Indonesia, and in Bangladesh, and in Pakistan, and Myanmar, now called Burma, or was called Burma, now called Myanmar. And so we're talking about the fact that Islam has expanded dramatically outside of the Middle East. We're going to be talking about some of these world religions, so let's understand how these fit together. You can take three of the world's religions and put them all under Abraham. 18 million Jews, almost a third of them are in Israel, another third of them are in the United States, and another third are still scattered around the world in the so-called diaspora. About 2 billion people in different parts of the world that call themselves Christians, and 1.5 billion Muslims, which I just gave you in just a minute. So you can explain three of the so-called religions of the book. To add to that, we have two other major religions, which we're going to come back to with one of the other questions you asked me today, and that is to recognize that if you go back to the Indus Valley of the Aryans, you have about 900 million Hindus, about 360 million Buddhists. And so that gives you a little bit of an understanding of how these various religions come together. And in just a few minutes, I'll get to the other question, because I had a question on where do the Sikhs fit into the picture? And as we'll find out about Sikhs, they are actually kind of a merger of both Islam and Hinduism. So that's what we're going to cover for the next couple of minutes. Everybody with me? Let's go through this fairly quickly. And first of all, I thought we'd spend a little bit of time just giving you the brief history of Islam. Muhammad was born into a very powerful tribe in what today is called Mecca in AD 570. He was raised by his grandfather, later by his uncle because his father died, later his mother died. At the age of 25, he married a woman who was 15 years his senior. Up until that time, he had been traveling in caravans, but now he was a person of means because of her financial wealth. At the age of 40, then, said that he had a vision in which the angel Gabriel came and told him to recite. And that is to recite his words. And the word recite is the word Quran or recitation. And so he began to, in the midst of this polytheistic culture in Mecca, to begin to preach a monotheistic theology, a belief in one God. He was threatened because of this and eventually went into hiding, eventually left from Mecca to an oasis, which today is called Medina in AD 622. And now, after having been a prophet, he now is becoming a soldier and a commander, fights a number of battles, and eventually is so successful that he brings 10,000 men back to Mecca, takes Mecca, destroys all the idols in the Kaaba, and establishes this religion of Islam. Now, in the midst of that, something dramatic takes place. 2 years later, he dies. But rather than that being the end of Islam, it's the beginning of one of the most remarkable expansions of any religion in the history of the world. Because the Muslim army begins to move out of the Arabian Peninsula into Persia and takes all of that region there. And that would be certainly Syria, and it would be Iraq and Iran and some of the Stan countries. And the Muslim army also moves then across North Africa, takes all of Spain, it becomes Moorish Spain. And frankly, if it were not for the defeat of the Muslim army at the hands of Charles Martel in France, would have been the end of Christian Europe because Islam had taken so much of it. It eventually retreats back to the focus that we'll see in just a minute. But certainly that illustrates a great deal of what we find in the world today. Now, whether you're a Sunni Muslim or a Shiite Muslim, you almost always agree with what are called the five pillars of Islam. The first is known as the Shahada, or there is no God, but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. The second is the idea of prayers. They pray five times a day. The almsgiving, you are to give 5% or 1/20th of your income for the advancement of Islam. You have the fast of Ramadan. We just came out of Ramadan, which is fasting from sunrise to sunset during the 9th lunar month. And then, of course, you have what is known as the Hajj or the pilgrimage. And if you were to actually look at what is happening today in that region of the world, you will see that millions of people come to Mecca, to that airport, and they go to the region. They circle around the Kaaba. They begin to engage in all sorts of activities which were very instrumental in the establishment of the religion of Islam. We begin to see a little bit of a difference between Sunni and Shiite in terms of how they deal with the so-called scriptures of Islam. The primary one is, of course, known as the Quran, and that is the recorded revelation of Muhammad, 114 surahs or chapters that are put together, 86 of those chapters written when he was in Mecca. Those are the Meccan surahs, and the remaining ones are those which were written when he is in Medina. But also they have a belief that you can learn a great deal from the various sayings that were attributed to Muhammad, and those are found in what is called the Hadith. And so what we want to try to do now is answer that question. Why such a difference between Muslims that are Sunni and Shiite? And so let's, if we can, kind of go through this. And again, a lot of this is in the handout so that later on you can go to PrestonwoodExamine.org and find some of this. But again, there are these various divisions of Islam. And the first one is Sunni. These are the majority of Muslims. You find them in Egypt. You find them in Turkey. You find them in Saudi Arabia. And these are individuals that follow the Sunnah or the practice of Muhammad. Then you have, of course, the Shiites. We find them in the southern part of Iraq and in Iran. They are primarily Persians. And they, as we're going to see in just a minute, I'll go into more detail, believe that the leader of the Shiite Muslims needs to be in the direct lineal line of Muhammad himself. And then we also have the Sufis. I won't get into them too much, but they are primarily found in Iraq and are significant as well. And if you look at the division of Sunni and Shiite, the light green are all the Sunni Muslims around the world, and the dark green are the Shiite Muslims around the world. And so they differ on a variety of different issues. The first is certainly in terms of their size. As I pointed out, if you look at Sunni Muslims, approximately about 80% of the world. Most of the Muslims that come over here that I've met through international exchange programs when I speak on college campuses tend to be Sunni Muslims. But we do have some Shiite Muslims. As a matter of fact, Shiite Muslims have the facility right next to where Probe Ministries is located. We have the Hope Center, and right across the street are actually a Shiite Muslim it's not really a mosque, but it is kind of a religious center. But again, they are about 15% of the population. Sunnis will want to elect the successor to Muhammad and did so through the first caliphs. We'll talk more about that in just a minute. But instead, the Shiites believe that it should be back to Muhammad, so they followed Ali, who was actually related to Muhammad. The Sunnis will emphasize what we just talked about a minute ago, that is the Sunnah, the practice, and the Hadith. In other words, you ask any Sunni Muslim, why is that you wrap your turban while you stand? Because it's recorded in the Hadith that Muhammad wrapped his turban while he stood. Why is it that women are treated in this particular way? Because it's recorded in the Hadith that this is how women were treated in the 7th century. This is how women are to be treated today in the 21st century. By contrast, in the Shiites, they emphasize the authority of the imam. And the imams in Iraq are called imams, but the imams in Iran are called what? Ayatollahs. So now maybe you've heard that phrase as well. And more importantly, with many Sunni Muslims, you have some kind of separation of mosque and state. If you go to Turkey today, you recognize that even though Erdogan is the prime minister and is Muslim, there isn't an attempt to try to always impose all of those ideas on the culture, which is why you've seen all of these battles being fought and all these terrorist activities taking place in the Istanbul airport and elsewhere, because they are the more radical Muslims that want a theocratic state. And even before that, you know, you fly into the airport there, and the previous prime minister there, interesting enough, really tried to kind of keep some of that separate. And that is one of the reasons why there's a great deal of conflict right now in Turkey. By contrast, if you go to Iran, the Ayatollahs run the game. The Ayatollahs determine who can even run for office. So it is a complete theocratic structure where there is a complete merging of mosque and state. So you can see that there are some differences in terms of how that works out. But what's the history? Back to the question, you know, what caused these people to split, and why in the world do they kill each other off? Once you understand the history, you'll understand why the greatest threat to a Muslim today is oftentimes another Muslim, especially if that's of a different group of Muslims. Historically, this is where it was. The dispute was really over the question of succession. Muhammad dies in 632 AD. And so most of his followers wanted the community of Muslims to determine who the next successor would be. And so a smaller group instead thought that Ali, who was married to Muhammad's daughter, should be the next leader. Well, the Sunnis prevailed, and they weren't called Sunnis and Shiites quite yet, but the group that became Sunnis prevailed, and they chose the first caliph, and he was the leader for Islam. Then they also selected the second caliph as well, and then the third, but finally Ali was selected as the fourth caliph. Interestingly enough, but then, interestingly enough, the battle began to break out, the conflict between the two, and the first earlier caliphs were murdered. A war erupts, and then Ali, as the caliph, he's murdered as well in AD 661 near the town of Kufa, which is present-day Iraq. And now this, at this point, split it. You ever heard of, like, the Hatfields and the McCoys? Now, think about that. Now, for some of you younger ones, no, I've never heard about that. Okay, think of Northern Ireland and the Catholics. Something like this. You know, there's bad blood, and this is what has now unfolded between the Sunni and Shiites, because the split in the community created two branches that actually never again united. Okay, Ali is killed in this battle, so now perhaps one of the other most famous figures in Muslim life was a man by the name of what? Hussein. To see how important it is, recognize that today when Muslim boys are born, oftentimes they're either called Muhammad or Ali or what? Hussein, right? Saddam Hussein, Barack Hussein Obama. I knew she was going to get me into that one. When they're beating me to the punchline, we're in good shape, you know. By the way, if you want to learn a little bit more, you might go to the Dinesh D'Souza movie. We had a chance to go to that, Hillary's America, and even the earlier one, Obama's America. I mean, you'll learn a great deal about that. But anyway, Hussein is now leading the Shiites. Now this is the faction being led by Hussein, and eventually his family and his compatriots and all of them are massacred. He's decapitated. His head is put on a pike, and you can see now it's getting really bad between the Sunnis and the Shiites. And as a matter of fact, to this very day, for the Shiites, the killing and decapitation of Hussein is a major issue and a major symbol. And here's just one picture from a political protest. This is a Shiite Muslim, and he's holding, look at how huge that is, a picture of Hussein, the Imam Hussein, held in one of the Shiite Muslim protests. And so you can begin to see how there is just incredible bad blood. Now you might say, this man was killed in the 7th century, right? The killing of Hussein, you would think you would get over this, but it's kind of like I said, the Hatfields and the McCoys. This bad blood is continued on ever since this day. You go to Iran, you go to certain parts of Iraq or other place where you have a Shiite stronghold, and they will still have pictures of Hussein who was killed. And they will name their children what? Hussein and Muhammad and Ali, especially Ali, because these are those that show that we are the rightful heirs of the Muslim heritage. And of course, then the Sunnis generally just kind of ignore them. But one group of Sunnis called ISIS, they want to eradicate. They want to completely destroy all of the Shiites. If you're a Muslim who is seen as heretical, your scene is even lower than the pagans and the Christians and the Jews. They want to completely eliminate you because you're causing dissension within the caliph and ultimately within the caliphate. See how important that is? So this is why I said one of the greatest challenges and greatest threats to a Muslim is another Muslim. If you are of the wrong sect, you're in real trouble. Now, there's one other point I want to make, and then we'll go on to our next point. And that is, interestingly enough, when we talk about the fact that most of these Shiite Muslims are in Iran, those in Iran, a majority of them also are what are called Twelvers. Now, if you've ever heard Joel Rosenberg, he's talked about this before, because back in the 10th century, there was a 12th Shiite imam, and he went into hiding. They say he went to an occultation. And so they believe he is still alive. And he's out there waiting to return. And his name is Mahdi. This 12th Imam is known as Mahdi. And he is waiting to return. And will return in the midst of a global conflict. He will return to rescue Iran, or rescue basically the Shiite Muslims. And so they believe that that is the case. And so these 12er Shiites exist in what? They exist in Iran. The past president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, was a 12er. And the danger of this is that they believe that in a major conflict, like a nuclear war, Mahdi will come in and rescue them. Which is why some people have said that this would be the worst of any Muslim nation to ever get a nuclear weapon. There's some political things I could say about the nuclear deal that we have there, but I'll leave those for the rest of you. But you can see some of the real questions about that as well because of the belief of those Shiites that exist in Iran. Real quickly, I might just mention, if you have Muslim friends, how could you maybe witness to them? And the first thing that I've mentioned before, and again, we're giving away some free copies of my book in case some of you that are visitors would like to get a copy there, is I think the first thing is that you could show them that you can find Jesus in the Quran. For example, in the Quran, in Surah 3, it says that Jesus was born of a virgin, that he is the Messiah, that he has power over death, and that he knows the way to heaven. So right there, just saying, well, wouldn't you like to know more about this prophet? Your religious belief says he's at least a prophet. Wouldn't you like to know more about this prophet that can do all these things? There's a part in Surah 19 where it actually says that Jesus is sinless. Now, there's another part in the Quran, which is actually where Muhammad is told by Allah to be asked for forgiveness for his sins. So that means Muhammad was sinful, but Jesus was sinless. Would you not like to know more about this sinless prophet who was born of a virgin, who is the Messiah? And it even points out that Muhammad did not know what would happen to his followers. But here, of course, we have the idea that Jesus knows the way to heaven. Pretty interesting. So, first of all, show them that that Jesus is even in the Quran. Number two, show them that they can read the Bible. Because they're going to learn the most about Jesus by not reading the Quran. They're going to learn about Jesus by what? Reading the Bible. What? Give them permission to read the Bible. Ask, for example, he says, ask those who have read the scriptures that came before you. When they talk about the scriptures that came before you, they're called the before books. Matter of fact, you see that in Surah 4 as well. And that is, he tells them to read the before books. Well, it'd be the Old and New Testament, the books written before the Quran. They're to observe the Torah and the Gospels. So again, we give them permission to read the Gospel and to permission to read the Bible, and you can give them the Gospel of John. And so I think it's a very effective way to begin to witness to your friends, to show them that Jesus is in the Quran and that they can read the Bible. More importantly, I think it's also important maybe to make a distinction between the character of God. Because one of the things I've shared before is a study that was done found that one of the most compelling arguments for a Muslim is the idea that they could have a loving relationship with God. They could know God. Because in the Quran, there's kind of a belief in Unitarian monotheism. In Yahweh, there's Trinitarian monotheism. Allah, there's sort of a master-slave relationship. But here in the Bible, you have the father-son or father-daughter relationship. Allah determines all, but God is sovereign but allows free will. And so in a sense, there is this sense in which you could actually get to know God. And in the most extensive survey ever done of former Muslims who have converted to Christianity, they asked, what was the most compelling argument for you to leave Islam and to become a Christian? Number one answer, the love of God. So talk about the love of God when you talk with your Muslim friends. And again, the key issue here is salvation. They believe that maybe they can do enough good works that maybe Allah will allow them into paradise. But the good news is there is nothing we can do to merit favor before a holy God. But the good news is that we can be saved by grace through faith. And so I think the key verse is Ephesians 2, 8, 9. If you want to just have one verse in your head as you witness to a Muslim, that's the key verse. That we are saved by grace, not by works, lest any man should boast. That we might have what? Eternal life. Well, finally, there was a question about Sikhism, and I'll do this fairly quickly because some of you might say, yeah, what about this? Because I see some of these people with turbans, and they look kind of Muslim, but, you know, they also seem Hindu, so what is that all about? Real quickly, we'll answer the question about Sikhism. And that was a religion, interestingly enough, that was founded in the 15th century in India. It is a kind of an interesting mix. Almost three-fourths of the people that are Sikhs live in Punjab, India. There's about 30 million of them worldwide, but a lot of them are in India. But we're seeing quite a number here. We have a Sikh temple not far from where this church is, so obviously you may occasionally run into an individual that is a Sikh. The principle that is really kind of the foundational for this particular religion is that all people are equal, and thus they reject any kind of discrimination on the basis of gender, caste, family, or beliefs. As I mentioned just a minute ago, Sikhism is really kind of an interesting mixture in which it's had a little bit of influence of Islam, but primarily still has sort of Hindu roots. And a lot of these religions that have come out of India follow what's called syncretism. That's a big word. Hate to give big words just before lunch, but okay, let's think about this. Syncretism, it's like going to lunch, you know. You ever gone to Luby's cafeteria, you take a little bit of here and a little bit there, and pretty soon you look at your tray and say, what have I done to myself? Well, that's the same kind of thing. I take a little bit of this philosophy, a little bit of that philosophy, and that's really syncretism. And so the primary belief here, though, is that even though it has some Hindu roots, it's very much like Islam in that it believes in one God. Now, the difference is the name of that god is Satnam or Ekankar, and maybe some of you have even seen some advertisements around the Dallas Metroplex for Ekankar, so that kind of ties you into Sikhism as well. And also, Sikhs primarily believe in reincarnation and karma. We've talked about this before in our class, haven't we? This idea that, indeed, you have to be born again and again and again. And your station in life in this life was determined from your past karma of your past life. So again, some of the key verses that we've talked about before in terms of dealing with reincarnation, if you're witnessing to a Sikh, I'll say more about that in just a minute. One of the interesting things is their social teachings teach that they are to refrain from drugs, alcohol, and tobacco, and Sikhs do not cut their hair, which is why they wear those turbans, because they have an enormous amount of hair that, especially as an adult, they have to address. Their theology, I think I've already sort of alluded to that pretty much. They worship a single God and as a result do not believe that God could be born or die. So that's why they reject the idea of Jesus as God. They don't believe in the Trinity. They oftentimes, again, because of the influence from Islam. See, in Islam they say that God cannot have a partner. You know, and so that's, they reject the idea that there is a Trinity, but they also reject the idea that God could come in human form, that God could be born, that God could die. Some of the things that Jared was talking about today in the service, you know, that was, I think, very important. They believe in the writings of a guru and are not necessarily believing that the Christian scriptures are inspired. So when we talk about witnessing, again, they believe in reincarnation and follow those practices of their faith. But it's a good question to ask. Can you be good enough to eventually escape this devastating cycle of reincarnation? The same kind of questions you would want to ask of a Hindu. Can you ever achieve perfect life, a perfect life? And then what happens when you do achieve that? Because in the Hindu philosophy, you just become one drop in this cosmic ocean of consciousness. That's not very appealing if you think about that. The fact that we will live again. You know, Jared's talking about all the people he's going to talk to, you know. Spurgeon and A.W. Tozer and even all sorts of other people, you know. And the fact that we would still have our personalities. We would still know who we are. But I think also another key verse would be John 14:6, because oftentimes they will say, well, there are many paths to the top of the mountain. No, Jesus came and said what? No one comes to the Father what? But through me. Very key. And again, Ephesians 2:8-9 to share that only by God's grace can we be saved. So again, those are some of the tough questions you've put on the table for me this week. Hopefully we've answered a couple of them. But if you say, I'd like to learn a little bit more, let me mention a couple of books and resources. First of all, one of our staff members, Pat Zuckerin, has pulled together what we think are some of the most important questions people have about various religions. And so this book, World Religions, I'll see if I can bring a few copies. We'll give those away one of these weeks here if you want. And Pat Zuckerin has done a very good job of pulling together not only the essays that he has written, but some others on our staff. And so if you wanted kind of a good world religions book written from an evangelical perspective, taking biblical principles and helping you understand some of these religions, that's a key book. And then we're giving away some copies today of my book on Islam. So I think that would be helpful as well if you wanted to learn a little bit more about that. So keep the questions coming. I'll do my best every week to see if I can try to figure out a way to begin to give you a chance to hear some of the answers to the questions. Parker?